Move to the second case today, which is Broad Maintenance versus CSX Transportation. Mr. Monroe.
Good morning. My name is Donald Monroe. I represent the rail carriers that are the appellants in this matter. I'd like to begin by suggesting that this is, in fact, a deceptively simple case, and that's because the answer to the question presented is right there in the language of the act in question. Can employers require the substitution of paid leave when their employees take unpaid leave under the Family Medical Leave Act, notwithstanding existing agreements? 2612 tells you the answer. It's right there in black and white in the statute. It says employers may require substitution, no qualifications, no exceptions.
Mr. Monroe, forgive me, but if this is a simple case, I am surely a simple because I've had some problems here. Under the collective bargaining agreements, the employs the right to determine when and on what terms. Are there any procedures for determining how leave is taken?
Well, Your Honor, there's variation in the various agreements at issue, but the primary set of agreements are the National Vacation Agreements. And in general, what they provide is that the timing of vacation is negotiated on an annual basis between the carrier's management officers and the union, so that people can bid for times that they want, and there's an arrangement that's planned out as to when people will be able to take their vacations sort of over the course of the year.
Right, so that everyone doesn't take their leave time between Christmas and New Year's.
Correct. My reason for stating that this is relatively simple is because 2612, which it says this, that you can require substitution of leave without exception. Everything else in this case, everything else, every argument, every point raised in the briefs, every citation is an effort to evade or nullify that language.
But see, doesn't the phrase may require substitution, 2612D2, suggest that there would be situations where employers would not be permitted to require the substitution of paid leave for FMLA leave?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I can think of two circumstances where that would not be the case. May require is, and I think that the case law on this is pretty clear in the record, may require is an unqualified grant of authority. Had Congress wanted to make that qualified by on the score of existing agreements, it certainly could have said so, and it did so in other provisions of the Act. So, for example, you have 2652A, which says that the FMLA shall not diminish the obligation to comply with greater family or medical leave rights. So, for example, had a carrier or any employer agreed after the passage of the FMLA that it would not require substitution, you have, at that point, a right that is a greater family or medical leave right. And why is that? Because the right that is granted by the FMLA is a qualified right. It is a right to take 12 weeks of unpaid leave subject to the right of substitution.
So are you suggesting that any other explicit bargained for rights contained in collective bargaining agreements could be overridden by the FMLA as long as the rights were not greater family?
Well, Your Honor, I think that is probably too sweeping a statement of our position. What we would say is that may require allows employers to require substitution notwithstanding anything that may be in the agreements that may be affected by substitution. Remember, we're not talking here about agreements that say if there is the passage of a Family and Medical Leave Act in the future. Employers may not require substitution if such a right of substitution is granted. None of the agreements say that. We're not talking about agreements that contemplated the FMLA. We're talking about agreements that merely allowed employees to schedule paid leave. And remember, we're not talking about a situation where these agreement rights, the rights to schedule paid leave, are waived or abrogated in a vacuum. This only takes place when employees exercise their FMLA rights. It only takes place when they say, we're taking FMLA leave. And the reason it takes place is because this is adjunct to, the substitution right is adjunct to the right to take the leave in the first place. It never comes up otherwise. So we're not, this is not the sort of broad abrogation of contractual rights that has been posited by the
union. Is the Family Medical Leave Act leave time sensitive? In other words, you're governed by something outside just desire to take leave at a particular time, you're just, birth or adoption or whatever. Is that?
Well, the problem arises in a number of different circumstances, and there are different kinds of FMLA leave. There are some that is block or continuous leave, whereby an employee says, I'm going in for heart surgery, or we're adopting a child. I know when that's going to take place. I know how much time I'm going to need off, and they put in for it in advance. That can all be planned for, and the employer can adapt to that. But it also includes the right to take intermittent leave. And intermittent leave can be taken on less than a daily basis, even. It can be out for a couple of hours. If you have a doctor's certification that you need intermittent leave because, for example, you have migraine headaches or back pain or something else that would require your absence from work, employees can simply call up 15 minutes before their shift is supposed to begin and not show up for work. And in the railroad industry, that's a particular problem because it's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week business, and you've got, especially just for example, operating employees, if they miss that train, they're done. We have to bring in somebody else to substitute for them. If they're out for 1 hour, we lose their work for an extended period of time. So the anti-stacking provisions of the Act, which Congress obviously believed were very important. Keep in mind that anti-stacking was in there from the very beginning. Congress wanted employees to be able to take a reasonable amount of leave, but it clearly recognized that employers already provided substantial amounts of leave, both paid and unpaid. So it could have simply layered the new statutory leave on top of existing leave, but it didn't do that. And in fact, no one, not even the most ardent pro-employee lobby, ever suggested such a thing. Anti-stacking was in there from the very beginning. And in fact, it's much more important, the anti-stacking rules are much more important in the rail industry than in other industries for the reason I've described. In addition, because you have this long history of collective bargaining, rail employees are entitled to large amounts of paid and unpaid leave already. If you look through the record and you add up the various amounts of leave that employees could take, personal leave, sick leave, vacation, some of them would be entitled to as much as 11 weeks of paid leave. If you add the 12 weeks of unpaid FMLA statutory leave on top of that, you're talking about a scenario where employees could be out of work for more than 20 weeks of the year, and that's no way to run a railroad. You can't operate your business if employees never show up to work. So coming back to my basic point, I would like to say, don't make this case more complicated than it needs to be. Don't lose sight of the language of 2612. It is the beginning and ultimately the end of this case. Because as both the Supreme Court and this Court have said on many occasions, if you can apply plain language, judicial inquiry is over.
Are there any other examples of statutes the effect of altering bargaining agreement upheld in spite of the Railway Labor Act's prohibition against terms in a collective bargaining in collective bargaining agreement?
Well, Your Honor, probably the best example of that is the UTU v. Consolidated Rail case. That was Judge Friendly's decision in the rail reorganization cases, where Congress said, much as it did in the FMLA, you may do this. And the union said, wait a minute, you can only do it if it's not prohibited by existing agreements. And as Judge Friendly explained, well, of course not. The may is an unqualified grant. Congress did not say you may terminate employees unless barred by existing agreements. And that's a key point. Congress certainly knows how to preserve existing agreements. In fact, it did so in this statute. It did so in 2652A and in 2614A. So when it wanted a savings clause, it included one expressly. I'm into my rebuttal time unless you had any other questions.
Thank you. Ms. Parzelli?
Please the court. My name is Carmen Parcelli, and I am here today on behalf of all the appellee unions for purposes of this argument. We respectfully request that this court affirm the decision of the district court below. There are three main points I would like to address today. First, I'd like to start with the issue of statutory interpretation, statutory construction. We submit that the carriers cannot use the permissive language of the Family and Medical Leave Act to avoid the compulsory mandates of the Railway Labor Act. As counsel was discussing, what the statute says, the provision which they rely upon so heavily, is simply that an employer may require this substitution. There's simply nothing in that language that compels the employer to require it or would require it to act in a way that's inconsistent with its bargaining agreement.
But
it's simply a choice.
Sorry.
No, Your Honor.
If the FMLA intended to preserve all contractual provisions in pre-existing collective bargaining agreements, why does the statute specify only that it does not interfere with collective bargaining agreements by greater family and medical leave rights? In other words, under your proposed interpretation, wouldn't the FMLA say that it does not give bargaining agreements general, instead of specifying providing greater?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that the Act would have to have the language that you're discussing. I think the language that's there now does it. And it works this way. We have 2652A, which, as a threshold matter, we submit does cover the collective bargaining arrangements that we have here, that what we have here does grant a right greater than what an employee would otherwise enjoy under the Family Medical Leave Act. Okay, so that's a threshold argument. But say that that argument, as the district court below, is not accepted. Still, what 2652A says, it's really, it's not a savings clause, okay? I believe that's a misnomer. What it is a principle of statutory construction, and it says that nothing in FMLA shall be construed to diminish greater family or medical leave rights found in a collective bargaining agreement. Okay, so we have Congress telling us that part of what it wants. Then you need to also consider it in conjunction with 2652B, okay, where Congress explicitly says that certain collective bargaining provisions can no longer obtain after passage of the Act, which are provisions that would give lesser rights. For example, if a union and an employer had agreed to 8 weeks of leave for these purposes, that, Congress has told us, no longer stands and is not permitted. So their view that somehow the A section is a savings clause, if we're not included in A, then this Act just, you know, overrides our collective bargaining agreements, negates the Railway Labor Act, it makes superfluous, it ignores the very explicit command in the B section that only certain bargaining agreement provisions give way to the Family Medical Leave Act. And really, the larger point here, and the one that Judge Anderson really keyed in on in his decision below, is the presumption normally is that Congress does not intend to disturb its prior enactments when it enacts a new law such as this. And
finish your thought.
that it doesn't intend that, and we see that repeatedly through the Act in its legislative purpose as well. We do have 2652A. Even if you don't think it, its scope quite meets our circumstances here, it expresses an intent, an overall intent. We also have 2652.3 of the statute, where Congress says, again, it doesn't want to discourage employers from applying even pre-existing policies. It's not talking about collective bargaining agreements, but policies that are more generous. It doesn't want to discourage that, doesn't want to inhibit that. And we also have 2651 of the statute, where Congress doesn't want to disturb any more favorable leave rights under state law. So again and again in the Act, we have Congress indicating that if employees, by virtue of state law or their collective bargaining agreements, enjoy an arrangement that is more beneficial than what the statute itself provides, that Congress wants that, that that's a desirable end, something to be avoided.
Have any of the collective bargaining agreements been renegotiated since the FMLA? Well, you're shaking your head. Yes, so do any of those agreements grant more specific rights to the employees? Or substitution?
There's, I think, two parts to this question. Let me hit the first part. Yes, there has been bargaining subsequent to passage of the Act. In fact, I believe it's even three rounds of sort of national bargaining on that level. So it's somewhat a point in this case that, you know, the FMLA is passed in 1993. It becomes, Congress delayed, in fact, its implementation for collective employers subject to a collective bargaining agreement, yet this issue didn't come up in most instances till about 10 years later that the carriers asserted this right. They say that it's subject to no limitations. So that answers part of the question in terms of, did you have bargaining that specifically addressed this issue? Well, the carriers, I mean, they've expressed that this is quite burdensome to their operations and all of this, but it's not an issue that until many, many years after the passage of the Act has come to the fore. So there's that aspect of it. But there have been there has been renegotiation where the essential collective bargaining terms about scheduling leave have been reaffirmed. And then, of course, when you have bargaining agreements under the Railway Labor Act, the continuing practices of the party, what's really happening on the ground, on the property, is considered part of the ongoing agreement. So it's not something that's just one-shot deals as you renegotiate. While we're on this topic of leave and how things work on the property, I'd also like to respond to some of the operational concerns.
Well, could you explain to me how an employee is disadvantaged by the interpretation that the given?
Yes, Your Honor. As these arrangements exist now, they are permitted to schedule in advance on a seniority basis when they're going to take, for example, their vacation leave. Personal leave, a little less notice, but vacation is especially this scheduling, although still personal leave within their discretion, subject to some contractual limitations. And this is an important thing. I mean, as was mentioned before, yes, railroads are 24/7 operations. No one will deny that, but it works the same for the employees too. And that is why they especially cherish this right to say when they're going to take leave. And, you know, it's bid on a seniority basis. It's not uncommon for someone to have to attain 20, 30 years of seniority to get sort of a coveted August vacation time, something that a lot of us take for granted, being able to go away at you know, a time when kids are out of school and families are off. So that's why it's important. A lot of these people work on an on-call basis, so they cherish the right to schedule, and that's why it's perceived as well, not just perceived, why it is a reduction due to the carrier invoking the Family Medical Leave Act on the rights that they had existing and in place prior to the Act.
Tell me how that would work. Say you had seniority, you wanted an August vacation, and if they then invoked the Family Medical Leave Act, what would that do?
Sure, Your Honor. Let's say you had not exhausted your vacation prior to when you have a need arise, you know, medical condition, where you have to take or need to take the Family Medical Leave Act. So in that situation, if you had scheduled, say, a December vacation period, the carriers would be making you use up that vacation time in conjunction with this family medical leave time. And then when December rolled around, then that's it. You've used up your allotment. So you've lost that right to bid and set in place for yourself this allotment. Now, the thing is, you know, we heard a lot about stacking and stacking being such a core purpose in the Act, but there's always stacking. I mean, if you are the employee who's fortunate enough to have, you know, used up their paid vacation earlier in the year, and then your need for Family Medical Leave Act leave arises, well, you're not deprived of your 12 weeks under the Act. You still get the full complement of 12 weeks. So I guess it's what I'm trying to say there is it's a bit overblown that stacking is such a central and core element of the statute. And also, it just doesn't jive with the overall legislative purpose. As this court observed in the Diaz case, what FMLA seeks to do, what Congress intends to do here, is set a minimum floor of leave requirements to apply broadly to all employees, regardless of whether they're subject to collective bargaining or not. And what Congress did not intend to do was set a ceiling through the Act, and yet that's what the carriers are trying to have the FMLA read to do here, is to set a cap on collectively bargained benefits that have been in place sometimes for decades and that employees have come to rely upon.
You know, Mr. Monroe told us that some employees have up to 11 weeks of paid leave in their ledger account, I suppose. You know, with 13 years' experience under the FMLA, is it true that most people, if they have an option of taking a paid leave or an unpaid leave, would not want to take a paid leave? I mean, I would think, you know, most of these people are living month to month or week to week, and you don't want to go without a paycheck for a long time.
No, I understand.
So in the real world,
well, again,
wouldn't you do that?
My answer to this is what I hear from my clients is because of this 24/7 on-call basis that a lot of railroad employees work on, they cherish the time off. I think the court can take notice of the fact that the rail industry has been busier in recent times than it had been for a long time. And therefore, there is a lot of pressure and people are expected to work very long hours. And even if it's unpaid time, there is a desire, and that's why, you know, conflict has arisen, people wanting and expecting to stand on the rights that they bargained for and exchange other, you know, Mr. Monroe said, you know, and implied that we get excessive amounts of leave. Well, other things are not sought and not obtained at the collective bargaining table if what employees want is more time off and more leave. So it's there's not a free ride. It's not like this is given gratis to employees. They bargained for it. They've given up other bargaining objectives in exchange for it. And there is simply no indication that we find in the FMLA that Congress intended to strip employees of any of that, of these longstanding agreements that they've bargained for. And we think, honestly, that the easiest route in this case is 2652A. And to read it in a way, and I believe it can be read in that way and not unnaturally, where it does encompass the rights that we're talking about here. They are greater rights that employees have by virtue of the way our contracts work than what they could normally expect under the FMLA if they were simply in an at-will work setting. So in that sense, I think it comfortably fits in with the language of that statute. Even if this court were to disagree with that, still, there is every indication in the Act that Congress intended to preserve existing rights. There is no indication. What there is no indication to the contrary. And that's what this court would need to find, in essence, an implied amendment is what the carriers are seeking the court to find, that through the FMLA, albeit silently, that Congress really intended an amendment and a curtailing of the Railway Labor Act. But the norm is to not find such an amendment by implication unless the court can locate some clear statutory language that would point it in that direction, or unless there's an irreconcilable conflict between the two provisions. But there is no conflict here. Comfortably, the FMLA can exist. The substitution right is an option that's there. But as the Department of Labor in its rulemaking said, it's subject to limiting factors such as collective bargaining agreements.
Thank you very much, counsel. How much time? You have 4 minutes, Mr. Monroe.
Thank you. Let me just say one word about the equities that have been mentioned here. Every time the unions talk about this, they make it sound as if the carriers are simply swooping in from above and taking away people's contract rights. They always skip the predicate step. The employee invokes their right to FMLA leave. Nothing happens until that takes place. The question here is not a conflict between the statute and existing rights. The question is, what are the contours of the statutory right that Congress provided? Is it an unqualified right that employees can just take leave whenever they want with no limitations? No. No, the statute is very clear. If you take FMLA leave, you are subject to certain conditions. With respect to the various statutory provisions that counsel mentioned, she referenced 2652B, she referenced 2652A, she referenced 2653, she referenced 2651, and the overall legislative purpose. And so what the unions have done is construct this sort of Rube Goldberg-esque interpretation theory that if you spin it all around, you can override 2612. Well, look at each one of the provisions they cite in isolation. Not one of them stands for the proposition that they're citing. Not one of them says you can negate the 2612 right. And let me make one final point about that. With respect to 2612, what's the point of it if it does not remove contractual impediments? An employer that is not bound by existing contracts already has the right to substitute. It doesn't need 2612. So the only purpose of 2612 is to remove any impediments, statutory, contractual, or otherwise, to allow employers to require substitution when their employees take FMLA leave. Unless there are any questions, I have nothing further.
Thank you, Mr. Monroe. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. We'll move to the third case today.